Every community has a place where people meet and stories are told. The East Coast has stoops, the South has porches, and in Alaska, we have Arctic entries.
Here, Alaskans share their personal stories, funny, sad, and sweet. These stories are originally told at our monthly event in Anchorage. At each live performance, seven people tell a seven-minute-long true story related to the show's theme.
I'm Jason Brandeis.
And I'm Rosie Robards.
Welcome to the Arctic Entries Radio Hour on KSKA Anchorage. Our theme for this show is Of Moose and Men. We have stories of creature companions, filling the freezer, and walks in the wild. To start the show, we have born and raised Alaskan Eric Dahl.
And here he is to tell his own true seven-minute story.
So, someone once told me that to be friends with somebody, it takes time and proximity. Those are the factors. But I would posit from my personal experience that if you want to really become friends with somebody, you need time, proximity, and mutual suffering. This story is an example of that. So I was out with a couple of my friends, Josh and John. We're all Alaska boys. I'd planned a trip out to go to Eklutna. It's the closest place to go camping. But instead of camping with all the families, we had determined to go on a bike camping trip out all the way to the glacier. It was going to be awesome. At the same time as this, we were meeting a new friend whose name was also John. So I'll call him New John so we're not confused. And he was from Arizona. He's never been tent camping in Alaska. And he was kind of having like a rough time, you know, at this period in time. We're like, hey, you know, we got to convince this guy to come out. We got to show him a good time. And I'm talking capital G, capital T, you trademark it, good time. Also known as bro time, because we're all dudes. So anyways, we get our bikes, we get all of our equipment together, and we go out to Eklutna. He was gracious enough to come with us. When we first get out there, of course, since he's not from Alaska, we have to go ahead and explain to him about bear safety. You know, we have bear spray. We've seen bears out here before. Don't freak out. You know, make noise. All the rules that you're supposed to follow, okay? And then we got down to the good time. And this is how we failed in delivering him a good time. So first thing is that the Alaska crew, we were all pretty well-versed on bikes. You know, we're just kind of the athletic types. We were good to go. Poor new John, though, had been at least a year since he had been on a bike, and I don't think he had ever biked with a backpack on. So, I mean, it's only like 12 miles or something, but it was 12 miles of straight suffering for this poor man, up and down ATV trails, across these, you know, the bike trails. So that was fail number one. Fail number two is that immediately upon getting there, I mentioned this was going to be a good time, bro time. So I wanted to make sure that I really kicked it off at the highest possible level. So I had packed secretly two Smirnoff ices. And if you're not familiar with the ritual of icing, it's where if you're presented an ice and you do not have an ice in response, you have to chug said ice right there in the spot, down on one knee. So after this grueling 12 miles on a bike that he suffered through, and I didn't even wait for him this entire time. We got there, and I just had a Smirnoff ice ready for this poor guy and made him chug it right there on the spot. He was gulping for air and gulping down malt beverage. Fail number two. Fail number three is we got there and we were starting to unload all of our equipment, and it turns out that the other John, Alaska John I'll call him, who should have known better, forgot the water. And this is silty water, so filters don't really work. So literally all we have to drink is Coors Light and whiskey. That's it for this camping trip. That's all we got. I just made this poor sucker chug a malt beverage. So that's fail number three. Anyways, we get all of our equipment together, we set up our tents, we get the fire going, we just start having, you know, we actually start having like a relatively good time. I mean, not a good time, but a relatively good time. Campfire conversation, bratwurst, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And then Alaska John, I think he was not on the good time train for this trip because he decided that the conversation, the campsite conversation, needed to be more provocative. And so instead of talking about something like religion or politics, he decides to ask the following question.
Hey, what's the darkest thought you've ever had?
Which literally, I mean, under normal circumstances, that's a weird question. But because I said that New John was feeling kind of down, because literally a friend of his had actually just passed away, this was the worst possible question that you could ask a man that's grieving. So, of course, it led to a conversation about how rationality is a disease and life is pain. Which is not a good time campfire conversation, let me tell you that. So at this point, it's dusk, it's dark. The Alaska crew is way drunker than New John because we were trying to show him how to have a good time instead of giving him a good time. Josh has gotten sick, and we decide, all right, it's time to retire for the night. And so because I had been stressing bear safety so much in my drunken state, I leaned over to New John and I said, hey, you know you gotta tie up the food in the tree, right? And he's like, yeah, I know that. It makes sense. Hey. But most people would throw a rope up and then tie it in and pull it up. But you know what I'm gonna do for you? I'm gonna climb this tree. I'm gonna put it up there manually. So with his mouth agape, I climb this a spruce tree, and tie the food up in there manually because I wanted to be that responsible. Anyway, so after that, we all retire. It's time to go to bed, so we all retire. And I retire to my single tent because I had brought a small one-person tent, and they all retire to the other tent with the bear spray because the needs of the many outweigh the needs of the few. Thus spake Spock. We're all nerds. Anyways, so that's how we retire for the night. And then karma kicks in. So although we had practiced all of our bear safety, I didn't so much as wake up as I came to the next morning, okay? And I always take a Bowie knife with me. I had it since I was a kid. So I have this Bowie knife, and I come to, and I already have it out. And I'm pounding it on the ground in my own tent because I'm by myself, staring at this gaping hole in the side of my tent and yelling, screaming for bear spray because a bear had literally torn into my tent. So in the other tent, the Johns, they had already woken up, and they had heard the bear shuffling around. And of course, Alaska John, who is the worst, Alaska John's the worst, just keeps going to everybody else in the tent. Because apparently I was going to be the sacrifice for this bear if anything is going down. They tries to rouse Josh. He decides to get dressed like a gentleman before doing anything else. And this is where I start screaming for the bear sprays at that particular time. So we all meet out. The Johns and I meet out outside the tents. And I'm like in adrenaline mode. Fight, complete fight. This bear is torn into my tent. And I'm going to show him justice. So I grab the bear spray from him. And I just start unloading. I just miss the area. It's like napalming this place. What I don't realize, though, in my adrenaline stupor is that the bear is actually a rather small black bear that has climbed up a tree, okay? And it's not even the tree that I tied the food in. It's just scared in a tree nearby, and I'm just unloading on the area, just unbeknownst. So at this point, I've gotten tunnel vision, and the bear eventually comes out of the tree, you know, because it realizes we're literally just not a threat. We're not a threat at all. And it saunters into my tunnel vision, okay? And I say, all right, now is my time to terminate this bear. So I point, spray, and completely miss this bear. Completely and utterly, no bear spray got on there. The bear eventually goes away because Josh comes out like a gentleman, completely fully clothed, and starts screaming at the bear. So, I mean, the bear was probably confused that such a well-dressed gentleman would actually start screaming at it. At this point, I'm coming down from adrenaline. I'm shaking, just wildly shaking. And Alaska John, he says, oh, man, I got an itch in my throat. And remember, I napalmed this entire area. It's like, it was DEFCON 4. You know, if you're in the vicinity, half-mile radius, you're smelling pepper. And then he just starts throwing up. He has a bad reaction. He just starts throwing up. I'm shaking next to him. New John's like, is this typical for Alaska? Because this sucks. This sucks. So anyways, the bear actually hasn't even wandered off that far. So it's pouring rain. We decide, all right, we're going to cut this camping trip short. We just got to cut our losses and get out of there. So we head out and decide to reconvene at Jackie's because that's the only place that we would think would serve people that smell of booze, bear spray, vomit. So the moral of the story is that, like I said, we were kind of good friends with New John at this point. And then after this, we became great friends with John. Because again, mutual suffering kind of brings people together. But I will say this. Although we're good friends now, New John, that was his first time tent camping in Alaska. And this was back in 2012. And he has not gone tent camping since. Because we really know how to show people a good time. Thank you.
We just heard from Eric Dahl on the Arctic Entries Radio Hour. Eric performs with Scared Scriptless and Urban Yeti Improv here in Anchorage, so you might catch him on the stage through one of those programs.
During this hour, we hear Alaskans tell short, 7-minute true stories about their lives. Our theme for this show is Of Moose and Men. Jenna Damaris hails from the sunny city of Philadelphia.
She'll take us abroad and back to an encounter she once had with a creature companion.
The summer after my sophomore year of college, I had an internship working for a valve company in Pune, India. Now, when you go abroad, people feel compelled to give you lots of advice. So the three pieces of advice that I received were, one, don't drink the water. 2, don't eat the food from the food vendors, from the street food vendors. And 3, don't pay anyone who is exploiting animals for tourist amusement. I thought it was kind of a weird piece of advice, yet it was plastered all over the city. So, okay, it was kind of legit. So I am settling into my time in India quite well. I'm getting to know my city, getting to know my job, but I'm having trouble communicating with people because my city wasn't a tourist city. I mean, not that many people have ever heard of Pune, India, so it wasn't a tourist city, not that many people speak English. So the only people I had to converse with outside of my supervisor was the 5 other students on my program. We were all from the same university, but none of us were actually friends before we got to India. And so as you can imagine, when you live, work, go sightseeing, do everything with some people, you become fairly close. Yet after 7 weeks, we actually started to hate each other, as one can imagine. So 7 weeks of this, working 6 days a week, we decide, you know, we deserve a vacation. We only have a couple weeks left. We should probably go see the rest of the country. So we decide to, and we also thought, you know, we're all sick of each other. Maybe we should get out of town, and that'll help us not to be sick of each other. So what we decide to do is take the most logical choice for a vacation and go on a 7-day road trip together across rural India. And actually, our vacation sounded like so much fun when we told our parents that my coworker Sam, his mom flew over to take the road trip with us. So, yeah, college students with a chaperone road trip. So, there were so many of us, there were too many of us to have more than one car, so we had a little caravan, 2 cars. And in India, if you're not familiar, a popular way to get around is to actually hire a driver. It's cheap, it sounds really expensive, but it's the cheapest and safest way to go. So our caravan, you know, starts off to Delhi, India, which in the middle of July is hotter than hell. We are getting tired and cranky, and it's setting into our minds that we're actually spending even more time together than we were back in Pune, and so we really start to hate each other. And so then we hit the second leg of our trip, and we go to Agra, which is where the Taj Mahal is, and that's actually a good day. Except for that night, that's really when things start to go south. And so we finally decide, we're actually fighting over the pettiest things you can imagine. Do we want chicken for dinner or should we go vegetarian? How are we gonna go to the movies? Are we gonna take a cab or rickshaw or are we gonna have our driver? Like stupid stuff. And so we're fighting over anything. And my friend Sam eventually gets to the point where he says, you know, Jenna, I think you are way too dominant and confident and forward as a female and that's not okay in India. Whether or not that's, like, really true is sort of up for debate, but I'm from Philadelphia, and so, like, that was not okay. So that conversation ends with doors slamming, and Sam stopped talking to me. So then I was like, all right, well, I'll go seek refuge in my room with my roommate, Ramya. Well, she had been dating this really hot guy back in Pune, and she was going on and on about how I missed him and how hot he was, and, you know, I kind of thought it was a little annoying. So I told her that, and she stopped talking to me too. So it sounds like I'm the common denominator here. I know that's what you're all thinking, but I promise you that no one was talking to anyone. It wasn't just me. Until about 4 a.m. when I get a knock on my door, and my coworker Nick didn't listen to rule number 2, ate food from the street vendor because he went by himself because we weren't talking to anybody, and had the worst food poisoning I can ever imagine. So finally we get up the next morning and we're finally on our last leg of this journey. Like this is the road trip from hell. And so we head out to Delhi, and as I said, we're heading out to Jaipur. Sorry, we'd already been to Delhi. And we have 2 cars, right? So I'm in the front van and there are 4 of us. And in this car is Silish, and Silish is brilliant, but like those people who are sort of off in their own world and never actually interacting with us mere mortals down here. So he was like meditating on something in the front with our driver. And then in the back, Nick is sprawled out. He's passed out, phasing in and out of consciousness because he's too weak from the food poisoning from the night before. And my roommate and I are sitting in the middle row. Our backs are turned towards each other as much as you can in a van, headphones in, and looking out the window. No one has been talking for hours. So we're driving across the middle of rural India, and we get to checkpoints. They don't have toll booths, so they have checkpoints when you go from state to state. So the driver gets out and goes into the checkpoint, which is like a little Alaskan coffee hut. You know, we're just chilling for about 10 minutes when a monkey lands on my window. All right, I don't see that every day, so I decide to take a picture, put my camera away, headphones back in, and go back to ignoring my friends. It turns out this monkey has an owner, and so he starts knocking on my window demanding payment. Now, for those of you who don't know me, I'm a rule follower, and I was told not to pay anyone exploiting animals. So I was not gonna pay this man. My real reason was that the only money I had was the equivalent of a $50 bill in one of those like not-so-secret tourist pouches that you wear under your shirt. In order to get this money, I would have to flash this man, which in rural India was really not gonna happen. So I did what any normal tourist would do. I put a smile on my face and gave him the international symbol for, I don't know what you're talking about. He didn't buy it, not that I blame him. So he starts knocking on my window and yelling at me even louder. Silas comes out of whatever he's thinking, turns around. Nick raises from the dead, and Rumya takes out her headphones. And they're all looking at me when we hear a little pitter-patter on the roof. Another monkey has landed on our roof. And my monkey guy and his five monkey guy friends are surrounding our vehicle, and they're very angry looking and all, for some reason, carrying like 6-foot-long wooden poles. Things aren't really going very well. And at this point, we're actually frozen because we're not talking to each other, not because we hate each other, but because we're terrified. We're in the middle of rural India. Our driver is nowhere to be seen. We don't speak their language, and they don't speak English. And we're surrounded by six very angry men with wooden sticks. So we're not talking, we're frozen, and I finally break the ice by saying, guys, I don't have any money, which is only partially true. So I don't have any money, and so we start to like grabbing in our backpacks and looking around for anything that we can find. So finally Silas finds a couple of cents or a couple of coins, which is like literally pennies in American dollars, and he opens the door and throws it out the window at this man, and who picks it up, and he's already angry and gets visibly angrier when we pay him this paltry sum, and then he just walks away. He sort of shakes his head and goes and then like snaps, and all his monkey friends and their monkeys follow him. And so they're just like gone, and all of us are like shaking in the middle of this car. Our driver comes back, doesn't say anything, and drives on. Doesn't actually take me very long to realize that the monkey guys and our driver are actually in cahoots with each other. So we get to Jaipur that night and we check into the hotel, and Sam and Matt from the other car race in, and they're dying with laughter. And they're like, they could see the entire thing happen in front of them, and they clearly knew it was a ruse. So they start making fun of us, and by that I mean me, because how could you have been so stupid to fall for such a tourist trap? I wasn't really ready to come down and admit that yet, but it was the first time in about a month that we didn't actually hate each other and weren't at each other's throats. So the next day, we head to the city palace in the middle of Jaipur, and as we get there, I see a snake charmer. The snake charmer is sitting just outside the gates with two baskets full of snakes. I go up to him, I say hello, and then I leave, because you can bet I was not going to take a picture.
That was Jenna Damaris, and you're listening to the Arctic Entries Radio Hour on KSKA Anchorage. Our next storyteller has had his share of pets.
Here's Marty Hanna.
I was raised on a 40-acre farm in northwest Wisconsin with my parents and four brothers. My parents had bought the farm after the milking barn had burned down, but it still had all the outbuildings and a small lake and nearby woods for us to go and play in. You imagine raising five boys wasn't easy for the parents, so they started raising us using the farm subsistence lifestyle. We did canned goods and ate local fish and game, raised beef and pigs, and chickens. My brother started out raising chickens as part of a 4-H project by incubating 50 eggs in his bedroom closet. They all hatched, of course, and within a couple of weeks, the smell was getting quite noxious throughout the house, so we had to move them out to the chicken coop where we reared them until they got old enough to become free-range chickens. So over the years, we kept getting more and more chickens, and my parents decided to keep 12 chickens for egg laying and a large rooster. The hens were pretty easy to figure out. They were already laying the eggs, and we selected the largest rooster. Fred. Fred was pretty good at watching over the hens and was quite diligent at his duties. In subsequent years, we kept getting more and more chickens from the fertilized eggs, thanks to Fred. So soon, we had more than 100 chickens running around the yard, again, free range. They were in the garden when we were weeding. They were sitting on top of the cars when we were going out to school in the morning and everything. Well, about 4 years later, we moved to the edge of town on 10 acres so we could get my mother closer to medical treatment. She had just had a stroke. We took 12 egg-laying hens and, of course, Fred the Wonder Chicken with us. Soon the neighbor dogs and the local foxes had decimated the hen house down to where the only chicken remaining was Fred. The hens had a habit of, when the dogs would come, they would run away, making them easy targets for being bitten. Fred, on the other hand, would turn, beak snarled, talons in full force, and battle the chickens. And of course, Fred had the advantage that he could fly away. So, over time, Fred became, again, the only chicken, so he became a quasi-pet for the house. We would even take him cruising in the car on weekends. You gotta remember, this is Wisconsin dairyland, so there's not a whole lot going on. We wouldn't have other little parlor trick with him where we could hypnotize him by laying his back in the hollow and just moving your fingers real quickly in front of him, and he would lay there on his back for 2 or 3 minutes. Bark! And as long as no one disturbed him, he'd be fine, and eventually he would pop back up. So he also had a habit that on cooler evenings, he would roost himself up on the kitchen steps rail right underneath the stove exhaust so he could keep warm. If you were coming in later at night after a couple of beers or trying to sneak a girl in, Fred would let mom know that you were home. On really cold nights, we would put Fred down in the wood cellar with feed and water and that because it got really cold back then. On January 30th, 1982, it was 22 degrees below zero. We had been in a cold snap that entire week. The windows on the house were frozen over. There was icicles in the seams. We had taken old clothing and towels and shoved them in the windows as hillbilly insulation to keep the drafts out. On that morning, I was recovering in my bed after knee surgery the week before. My two oldest brothers were off at college, my mother and youngest brother were at a hockey tournament, and my dad was checked out. My next older brother, Casey, had contracted pneumonia, and he and his girlfriend brought in some baby kittens to my room with a bowl of milk so that the kittens could be fed without the dog and the cat drinking their milk. I woke up, said, yeah, sure, took another Percocet, and went back to bed. I woke up about an hour later to the mother cat clawing at the door and meowing. I smelled something burning and figured my brother was home burning breakfast. I reached down and removed the towel that was keeping the drafts out from underneath my door to let the cat in. As I opened the door, I saw the entire hallway was filling with smoke. I quickly surmised it was a fire, even under Percocet. I slithered on my belly over to my brother's room, picking up the phone, and it was already dead. Remember, this was corded phone days. I looked down the railing, and I could see that the landing was already on fire and flames were licking out. I called out, but no one answered. I quickly returned to my room, and because it was so cold, I already had my socks and sweats and a t-shirt on. I threw on a hoodie, emptied out my hockey bag, and threw the kittens and the mother cat in there. I knew I wasn't going out down the steps. I grabbed my crutches and went over to my old room because I knew the outside there was, over the porch, the roof was a slower drop down to the ground. I used my crutches and busted out that frozen window as well and got out onto the porch. I used my crutches to lower the kittens down onto the ground. And I knew there was a low-hanging branch, and I swung on that until I was far enough out to drop down into the snowbank, snow angel style, so I wouldn't wreck my knee. At the time, I forgot that my brand new knee brace was still sitting in my bed that I had never even worn. I worked my way over to the kitchen door, opened it up, and yelled again. No one answered. I grabbed a pair of shoes and my hockey skates. you never know when you're going to need your hockey skates. Even at this moment, I was like, hey, got to get my skates out. Not thinking, I just dumped all the rest of my hockey gear out up in my room. I worked over to the neighbor's house and quickly called the fire department and left the kittens in there with them. The fire department was there rather quickly, and my neighbor had brought over a coat so I could stay warm. The fire department quickly learned that the house was actually a chimney fire from a supplemental stove we had in the basement, and the only way to put the fire out was to knock the walls down. They were able to remove a lot of the family heirlooms and that out of the salon, and but other than that, everything was lost other than what I was wearing. This is a small town, so over time, people were coming by and seeing what was going on. You know, not much going on in the middle of winter. I managed to give away all the kittens at that time, and soon my brother returned from the doctor. He had gone there for the pneumonia and getting his pills and everything. He gave me and the dog a ride over to a friend of mine's, and he went on to tell my mother what had happened. So that evening, my friends, trying to console me and show me a good time, got a couple of 12-packs and went over to the house. All the structure was completely burned down. There was nothing left it other than a lot of glowing embers in the bottom, including where the wood cellar had been. I hadn't given a thought to Fred. As I'm standing there, looking around, thinking about it, I hear a soft caw, caw. I work my way over to the corner of the foundation, and under a set of scorched lilac trees covered with soot, there was Fred roosting warm on the corner of the foundation. Fred lived a long, happy life after that. He still survived. Thank you.
That was superhero Marty Hanna, and you're listening to the Arctic Entries Radio Hour on KSKA Anchorage. Our theme for this show is Of Moose and Men, and Christy Everett Jordan has had her share of animal encounters.
While living in an old trapper's cabin, Christy woke up to a bear on her porch and another bear on the roof. While running on a single-track trail by Chester Creek, she was kicked by a charging mama moose as she drove out from under its front hooves. But neither experience scared her as much as parenthood.
I stand here at the base of the Kenai River, hands clasped around my pole, with nothing but an empty net and a hope for a fish to find it. I wait alongside thousands of other Alaska residents for a sockeye salmon to find my net. Not the net inches from mine, not the net at the front of the line, but mine. I want to be the chosen one. I silently talk to the fish. Please, please find my net. I talk to the folks around me as diverse as they come, all of us united by fish. When a fellow dip netter loses a fish at the shore and stands there shaking his head at his empty net, I feel the guy's pain. I've been there before. Haven't we all lost something? Arrived empty-handed, heart shattered when we expected to be full? When tragedy calls my name, I deny or blame or try to rewind time like Superman saving Lois Lane. When it happens to other folks, I question their decisions or label them as a smokescreen to keep me safe. Like the way people often give me false praise for raising a child with special needs. God must have chosen you to be his mom. You are so good, so kind, so brave, because if there is something special about me, then maybe it couldn't happen to them. But it could happen to anyone. Chance, luck, the fish that swims past a thousand nets and gets caught in mine. I lick the salt from my lips, remnants of waves far bigger than me, waves that crest and break when I can't escape. I can't feel my fingers, my arms ache, my bladder's as full as my belly's empty, but I stand chest high in the 50-degree water for hours, waiting for that first fish, for the rush of a salmon swimming full tilt into the net I hold. What if we didn't have to wait that night in the emergency room? Nick and I alone in a room, the night my water broke 4 full months too soon. This can't be happening. It's not time. Please stay in. Please. Not now. Not me. Please. When a nurse finally checked me, she saw my baby's foot and couldn't hear his heart. And that's when everything happened too quickly. I remember my husband's eyes as they wheeled me away for an emergency C-section, the fear in me practically bouncing my legs off the gurney. I wanted nothing more than to rewind back to my bed, Nick asleep by my side, baby boy safe inside, rewind. I woke up in a surgery recovery room with an unfamiliar doctor by my side. Where's my baby? She told me he was in the newborn intensive care unit. Is he okay? Her dark brown eyes looked into mine and she said, he's alive, but I can't tell you he's going to survive. Our first child, Elias, was born with an Apgar score of 0. No movement, no heartbeat, no breath. At 5 minutes, still 0. Our 1-pound baby died, and the doctors and nurses brought him back to life. I couldn't hold him for the first 2 weeks, so I planted my feet by his side, my hands on his isolette. I stood there, and I waited. We spent 94 days in that NICU, and despite dire predictions, Elias survived. 7 years later, he holds himself upright with the help of forearm crutches, which he uses to poke a salmon carcass on the beach. Mom, how do I undead the fish? How do I go back in time? How do I get a second try? What if we didn't have to wait so long? What if my cervix hadn't opened? What if I'd been more cautious? What if I look back at my boy at the beach and say, oh, bud, you can't. When I'm bigger, I can go out there. I can fish too. Yes. Yes, you can. And I mean it. I know we'll find a way for Elias to dip net too someday, though I must say, I love this time on the water without my kids. I love the physical work of holding the net against the tides, the beauty of the light on the ocean, the volcanoes in the distance, the simplicity of my role. Hold the pole, harvest fish. So different from parenthood. People often say to me, I don't know how you do it. What they mean is how I parent a child with so many needs. Elias's short list includes visual impairment, cerebral palsy, and autism. I don't know how you do it. What's the alternative? To not? Sorry, God, we said we didn't care if it was a boy or a girl, as long as it was healthy. You can take him back. I plant my feet in the sand, hold tight to my net, stay in the water, and wait. The woman next to me catches one, and I can't help but wonder out of the thousands of nets waiting, why hers? I mean, is it fate or timing or equipment or skill? I think it's chaos theory. I think everything doesn't happen for a reason. It's random and luck and just being in the right place at the right time, and we can point to our tools or our skills as factors in the bounty, but perhaps we can't pinpoint the cause. Just as I can't claim there's something special about me for raising a child like Elias, a child with an injured brain and miles between stones, I parent Elias by following his needs, winging it, and I'm always wondering if I'm doing it right. The strength comes from loving him, not from some innate goodness in my soul. I am not a chosen one, just randomly selected. A fish hits, and I flip and yank my net with everything I got. Please stay in, please. When I finally land the sockeye, I do a little dance around my net. Thank you. I lay my hands on the silver scales and study this first fish of the season longer than normal after waiting so long. Thank you, I tell the salmon with each strike. Thank you. I hoist my fish high up in the air as both an offering and a prayer for my loved ones who watch from the camp above. Yay, Mom, I hear Elias say as he claps his hands together the way that he does in his standing ovation of one. I bow to my boy. Then I turn back towards the water, pick up my net, wield my net like a direct line between family and sea. Luck and will, sustenance and soul. And as I face the oncoming waves, I think, one more, just one more. Thank you.
That was Christy Everett Jordan, and this is the Arctic Entries Radio Hour on KSKA Anchorage. Christy is a writer, and you can find more of her stories on her website, followingelias.com.
This hour, we feature stories of creature companions, filling the freezer, and walks in the wild.
Debbie Motoro is an author and a musher. She has 28 huskies in her Denali Park backyard.
It's late afternoon on my second Iditarod day. My dog team and I are about to leave the Finger Lake checkpoint. I'm standing on the runners of my dog sled, looking at my 14 huskies jumping, leaping, yipping, and yapping. They are so excited to go, and I am scared. We're headed into the Alaska Range, over the most technical part of the Iditarod Trail. We're about to go over terrain that include the switchbacks and steep descents on the Happy River steppes, the very difficult decline into descent into the Dalzell Gorge, the Buffalo Tunnels, and more. I've heard about these places for years. I've worried about them for months. To heighten my anxiety, I've just had to leave my best lead dog, Little Sue, in the hands of veterinarians. She has a slightly sore shoulder, and when I got in here, I knew that. I took her to the vets, and one came up to me and said, "Debbie, she's not hurt badly at all. But the trail ahead is as rough as it can be. There are holes the size of cars out there. That is no place to take a dog like Sue." And so I'm now looking at my dogs, clamoring to go. Youngsters, the rambunctious Juliet and Sydney, getting everybody all wound up, and there's nothing to do but go. I pull my snow hooks out of the snow, and we're off. Thank goodness, we are going uphill. I'm so excited. Maybe some of the steam will come out of this team, and I have a chance of doing my best for my dogs. But as soon as I think that, the trail levels out, and then we are cascading downhill. We're going fast. It's not even the steps. It's not that steep. But I see a tree, and I see a hole next to it. Two by two, my dogs jump into the hole and out, and then it's my turn. And I do my best. I hold onto the handlebars, but I crash, and I hit the tree hard. The sled leaves my hands. I sit up. My face is caked with snow, and I watch my 14-dog team run off on the Iditarod Trail without me. "Whoa," I cry. "Whoa, you guys have to stop." I know they won't stop. That's not what they do. And I start running. I'm clamoring, clomping, clomp, clomp, clomp in the snow. My Arctic boots are not easy to run in. My mittens are dangling at my side. I'm one flailing mess. All I can think of is I was not good enough for this. I shouldn't be out here, and I see trouble. In my mind, I'm imagining a terrible tangle. I'm imagining 14 dogs in a macrame knot, when Zeppelin and Spot will surely go after each other, Sydney and Julie will panic, sweet Reno might chew himself loose altogether and go bounding off the trail. I'm running as fast as I can, and then I hear barking. Could it be? Yes, I hear barking, and a running dog team does not bark like this. I go into the trees around a bend, and there is my sled, the snow hook hooked on a tree, my dogs lined out in front, two by two by two. At the sound of my voice, they look at me as if to say, "Where the hell have you been?" During the next few hours, we do survive the Happy River steps. It's not all pretty. There is another tree. This time, my sled gets hooked on it. It's right here. The dogs are there, and it is up to me to pull the sled off the tree and get down this, essentially, this cliff with a turn at the end. I do it. And at midnight, I pull in to Rainy Pass, high in the Alaska Range, and I'm greeted by the judge. "Debbie, where have you been? We've been worried about you." "Oh, I had a little walk right out of Finger Lake, but I made it. How does my face look? I know it's bleeding." "Ah, there's a little blood, no big deal." He shines his headlamp down the trail, shows me the straw for my dogs, my drop bags, water, and then he shows me this tent all lit up. He said, "It's warm there. You can sleep there tonight." No way am I getting in a tent with a bunch of mushers. I tell him, "Thank you, but I am going to sleep with my dogs. The Happy River steps are behind us. The Dalzell Gorge is ahead. We are fully committed." We leave Rainy Pass in darkness the next morning, but in the next 20 minutes or so, the sky brightens. I planned it that way. I wanted to run into the gorge in daylight, but I didn't plan for the unbelievable beauty we run into in the next few miles. I realize as the sky lightens and the landscape turns that beautiful sunrise alpenglow color that we're running up a seam between the flanks of two mountains. We're in a high, yawning valley, me and my dogs, and I cannot believe we've come to this place. For a moment, I forget that I lost my team, just a matter of, you know, a couple dozen hours earlier, maybe less, or that we're headed into the Dalzell Gorge. Instead, I lose myself to the huff of their breathing and the rhythm of their paws on snow. I call each dog's name: Sydney, Juliet, Reno, Spur, Kanga, Fang, Taiga, Wolf, Zeppelin, Snickers, Strider, Roulette, Spot, Topaz. At the sound of their name, they each leap ahead a little bit. A few cock their heads. I know I'll never forget this run. Well, within about half an hour, I want to forget everything about the entire day. The trail narrows, and we're going into side hills, and I cannot keep the sled on the trail. I slip off, end up in the willows, have to right the 150-pound sled, whatever it is, and we go further. There's a hole, get yanked in it. I'm feeling clumsy and inept, once again, like I have no business being out here. And then I hear the sound of machines behind me. Great, snow machiners are coming. Isn't that wonderful? I'll have a peanut gallery right now. What could be better? And I turn around to scowl at them, and instead I see a helicopter. It's skimming the trees behind me. And I think, for just a moment, how great, they're going to fly right by. I wave. I figure they're going to follow Jeff King, Martin Boozer, Robert Sorley, Dee Dee Jonro, those people who are now 100 miles ahead of me. But the helicopter stays. It might do one small circle, and it stays, and it feels like it's sitting on my shoulders. I feel the thwap, thwap, thwap. I see the camera dangling down, and I realize they're trying to film a back-of-the-pack musher having one heck of a bad run into the gorge. I crash a few times while they're there, and then I see it, my dogs, two by two, going over the edge of the trail. This is the 100-foot drop-off I've been worrying about, and the helicopter is right there with me. I am not happy. I hold on to those handlebars like there is nothing else on earth, and it comes time for me to go over that cliff, and I go, and it's essentially a free fall, maybe a little bit like a luge run that's quite vertical. The sled veers to the right, then to the left. It cranks hard. If you jump out of that trench, you are really going to have a hard time. But we do it. We get to the bottom of that drop-off. I set in my snow hooks. I run up to my leaders and praise them. Then I look at my friend in the sky, and I raise my hands victorious over my head, and with my middle finger encased inside of my Arctic mittens, I give the helicopter the gesture of my choice.
That was Musher Debbie Motoro live at the Alaska Center for the Performing Arts.
Our next storyteller on this hour of Arctic Entries Radio is Elizabeth Van Alstyne. Also known as Lily, she's a sophomore at Diamond High School and plays with the local youth symphony. Lily's story had a few choice words that had to be edited for public radio.
So, I'm Lily, and I have a story. Before I begin, there are three things you need to know. One, comedian Chelsea Peretti said you're either from a vomit or a ish family. And what that means is, when you're little and you tell your parents that you feel sick, they either tell you to throw up or go to the bathroom. Let's just say, I don't throw up. And the god-awful truth you have to come to terms with as an ish kid is that you can throw up at school and you'll be okay. It's gross, but people will get over it. However, if you poop your pants in the middle of class, you better be dead within the hour or crossing the border because you will not recover. You live your life on a razor's edge. Two, a few years ago, someone started a rumor that girls don't poop, which I think elite ladies can attest is pure conjecture. However, what is not conjecture, what I know for a fact, is that that someone was a certain camp counselor named Jean. Three, I had food poisoning. Who poisoned me? I don't know, probably Jean, it doesn't matter. I just think it's important for the group to know that this isn't something that just happens to me. Okay, so I was at camp, it was Saturday, and that meant that it's rec day. And so my group was about to go on the 10-mile Indian River hike. Now I understand that for a lot of you, 10 miles just isn't that bad, but try pooping a solid 5 of those 10 and you'll see things my way. So, we're going, we're making good time. About a mile out, I start to get this feeling, this little whisper of an idea, that my stomach and my brain are on fire and I'm going to die. And something in the force had shifted, and I realized that rec day was gonna get a little crazy. But in that moment, I realized something else, that I had to persevere. Because gosh darn it, I'm from a ish family. I haven't had everything handed to me. No, I have to fight to win my battles. And that's exactly what I tried to do, fight. Did I win? I wouldn't say that. it was really more of a participation medal type situation. But I tried. I mean, I really, really did. Like, I remembered that when you have food poisoning, you need to drink a lot of fluids, because, like, you're losing stuff. But you're not supposed to do that before you've lost the stuff, because that makes you want to poop more. And, like, I tried talking to my friends and looking at the gorgeous flora and fauna local to the area I was in, but friends are dumb, and I definitely had a low-grade fever, so all the green just kind of started to trip me out. But eventually, we got to a clearing where we were told to rest, and me, in my delusional fog, I thought, oh, okay, sitting down, this will solve my problems. Oh, how wrong I was. All sitting down served to do was push the fire up further into my body. And then we had to stand up, and I don't know if any of you have done the trick where you like stand on a tin can and you poke the edges in and then it like crumples. Well, standing up was the moment where the edges of my ego like poked in a little bit. And then my can would meet its demise about a mile after that when a counselor shouted, okay, you guys, that's 5 miles, we're halfway there. Yeah, so I pulled off to the side with my friend and we flagged down a counselor. Who can tell me who that was? Who has a guess? It was! Yes, it was Jean. Now honestly, I shouldn't talk crap about Jean, wordplay. Because honestly, he was a pretty good guy and he was just trying to do his job, which was keeping me alive. But you know those people, and everything they do is just wrong for the timing and the place, and they just don't know an audience. Like, for starters, the guy never stopped talking. Not once. As I would drag my lifeless corpse off into the woods to be violently ill, it was just a great decrescendo and crescendo of Gene. And that's not all, because the Gene conversational timeline is as bizarre as it is indiscriminate. Yes, I do have a thesaurus. And, like, here's how it went that day. Hi, I'm Jean. Let's talk about the root of homophobia in our society. Then I'm gonna let it slip that I, Jean, am 2 years younger than the counselor age minimum, which is 21, meaning I'm the same age as everyone at this camp. But then we're gonna bring it back with a 10-minute interlude on my favorite musician, singer, songwriter, St. Vincent. But then we're gonna, I'm Jean, so I'm gonna hit you with the fact that I'm hanging out with the camp flute instructor, but she's like 6 years older than me, so I just don't know how to feel about that. And then we come way down. Let's talk about our hobbies. I like Smash Bros. And so that's, nerd. So that's how it was for the 5 mile trek back to the camp van. And when I was told to write this story for my class, we had to decide like what changed about us as a result of this story. And mostly I live in constant fear of Jean finding out what I've done. But I also realized that there are two parts in me. There's the part that is like smart and can do stuff. And then there's the part that tries to drink water before I've had explosive diarrhea. And I think we all know who's in charge. Thank you.
That was Lily Van Alstyn, and this is the Arctic Entries Radio Hour.
Our last storyteller, Nelson Karpluck, is originally from Mountain Village on the Lower Yukon and grew up in Fairbanks. After a long wait, he finally has a story for us about filling up his freezer.
So I've been caribou hunting twice in my life before. The first time was with my buddy Tim and his dad, and we were just north of the Brooks Range. In this area, if you want to use your rifle, you got to be at least 5 miles off the road and away from the pipeline, and you can't use an ATV. This was a very eye-opening experience for me. Tim got a large caribou. He was a beast and hiked out most of the weight. But we got stuck hiking in the dark, almost eaten by bears, and it was the most terrifying and physically draining experience I've ever went through. One of those trips where you vow, you know, never again, never again. But 2 years later, Tim and I were like, hey, let's do this again. It's going to be awesome. And oh yeah, we're going to do it with less people. His dad can't make it. So we set off, same place, at least we know the lay of the land. And this year, though, it's going to be special for me because I'm going to get the first crack at getting caribou. And growing up in this state as an Alaska Native man, not having taken a large game has been this like giant hole on my resume of life. And you get reminded of it all the time, especially with social media, you know, friends, family, coworkers, just posting about their hunts and their trips. And it's accentuated even more when you see, you know, their kids, like little Johnny's first moose and like little Debbie's first caribou. I'm like, God, little Debbie, like, come on. Like, I'm 26 at the time. I got nothing to show. They're making me look bad. But it's going to be my time this year, my time. I'm going to fix that. So we're off on the hunt and we're out there a few days and eventually it gets to what we think is our last day. We've been holed up on this ridgeline, beautiful day, but 5 or 6 hours just sitting there. And eventually a caribou comes over the horizon and into the valley below. And it's not a trophy caribou by any means. It kind of looks a little feeble, maybe. And we think it has a limp. We decide that's going to be my caribou. Because we might not have enough time to get another one or see one. So we're ready, the hunt is on, Tim gets off and running, I'm running behind him, and I'm just so excited, full of emotion, energy, adrenaline, it's welling up inside of me. But then I stop and I'm just like, Tim, wait! He turns around, what? I gotta take a dump. And I guess I'm a ish kid too, but I really had to go, and there's no way, you know, nature's calling, no way I could hit ignore, decline on this. I should also mention that Tim gets angry very easily, and this really set him off. But as I scamper away to do my deed, I hear him laughing, and I can't help but laugh myself. So that's all done, and now we're really ready to start the hunt. We're running down the valley. It's about 2 miles or so, and we just realized that while I was fertilizing the tundra, the caribou's run off, and we don't know where it is. We put our bags down and start searching, and we find it. It's laying down in this little divot, like right behind a little hill on the tundra. So well played, caribou, well played. But Nelson's here now. It's my time. So I get ready, I get set. It's like 20 yards away, you know, a gimme shot. And Tim makes some noise, I'm aimed. It stands up, and I go to pull the trigger. And nothing happens. The safety's on, and the caribou runs off. And I'm failing right now. And we start chasing it, and it stops again. And so I have another chance. But by now, I'm so embarrassed and ashamed and feeling horrible that I'm just shaking, you know, just trying to aim at it, shaking so much, and I can't take the shot. And it runs off again, and Tim is angry with me. And we're just running after this thing all over the tundra, and it's definitely limping. So I think that's why I didn't just leave, but it stops again, and I'm just thinking, what luck? And I have a plan now. I'm going to kneel down. That'll stop my shaking, and I'll be able to take the shot. So I go to one knee, and I aim. And then this horrendous cramp makes me stand up, and I'm beside myself. The caribou runs off, and Tim is just, you know, doesn't know what to do. And I'm so glad this wasn't being filmed, but it would have been a great, you know, how not to hunt video, and I could see it going viral, hashtag epic fail, and like, who taught you to hunt? Elmer Fudd? Like, you know, just, and I tell Tim, I'm giving him excuses, you know, like, hey, you take the shot, I clearly am not doing this right, and he's like, no, this is yours, we're going to stay here all day till you do this, and we probably could have, the way it was moving, but we've crisscrossed the tundra so much that we're back to our bags, and I'm able to lay down on one, and the caribou stops, and I steady myself, I take aim, take a deep breath, and I take the shot. And it's good, and I'm so relieved, like that's a first feeling, and then, you know, I can do a status update now, right? But we get to the caribou, Tim congratulates me, and I'm kind of feeling a little judgmental now, though. It looks even smaller than I thought from the distance, and if caribou were Christmas trees, this is Charlie Brown's Christmas tree. And so I'm not too proud at this point. But we start field dressing, loading it up, and I can't help but notice it's all going to my pack. I mean, he's got the gear, and that's heavy, but I finally ask him, and he just stares at me, deadpan, serious. You caught it, you carry it. Fair enough. I knew how much he carried on the last hunt, so I got this. But as we hoist that caribou onto my back and I feel the full weight for the first time, I can't help but wonder, you know, maybe we should have waited, you know, for like a smaller caribou, like, you know, travel size. And that would have been better for me. But we got, you know, 5+ miles to hike out, and it's painful, it's horrible, it's awful. It's the second worst hike of my life. But we get back to Fairbanks. And, of course, I split up the meat with Tim. But on my end of things, since it is my first catch, and in our culture it's tradition to give that away, and especially to elders if you can, and I was able to give some to my relatives in Scammon Bay, who I haven't seen since I was a little kid, to my grandparents in Mountain Village. They said they made spaghetti out of it. And my mom and dad, of course, in Fairbanks, who were kind of, they didn't think they should be lumped in the elder category just yet. But I made that call, and they deserve it from just all they've been through. And at this point, though, I'm finally feeling proud about my hunt. And it's that feeling I had there that will forever be special, important, and way more meaningful than any social media status update ever could be. Thank you.
That was Nelson Karpluck at the Alaska Center for the Performing Arts, and this has been the Arctic Entries Radio Hour.
We'd like to thank our storyboard and the storytellers for this show, all of whom, by the way, are volunteers. Thanks to our audio engineer from the Alaska Teen Media Institute, Kendall Stormo. And thanks to Anchorage's own Super Saturated Sugar Strings for our theme music. I'm Jason Brandeis.
And I'm Rosie Robards. Thanks for listening, and we look forward to hearing your stories.